today on Against the Grain. What's happened as more things, tangible and intangible, have been brought into the market? How is this related to inequality and commodification, and to movements working to resist the status quo? I'm CS. UC Berkeley sociologist Michael Bourivoy shares his understanding of capitalist dynamics historically and in the present moment, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Pope Francis's pronouncements on capitalism, Thomas Piketty's assertions about inequality, Carl Polanyi's arguments in his book The Great Transformation, these and other resources were drawn upon in a presentation Michael Bourivoy gave to the International Sociological Association, a talk entitled Facing an Unequal World, that was eventually published in the journal Current Sociology. Michael Bourivoy, a professor of sociology at UC Berkeley and former president of the ISA, has written and lectured for many years on inequality, radical theory, and power and resistance under capitalism. Facing an Unequal World focused on what Bourivoy believes is the ongoing third wave of marketization, and the processes of commodification associated with it, and on attempts by movements to push back against the overextension of markets into more and more aspects of our lives. When Michael Bourivoy joined me in studio, I asked him how big of a problem inequality has become.
Well, it's a huge problem, and it has become an ever-increasing problem. Over the last 40, 50, 60 years, we see increasing concentration of wealth, increasing concentration of income, and the sort of the middle has been hollowed out. So there's been a considerable polarization between the wealthy and the poor. And so, of course, this has created all sorts of consequences, which I'm sure we will talk about.
You posit that inequality can be seen in two ways, as exclusion and as inclusion. Tell us more.
To talk about inequality as inclusion means to talk about the relationship essentially of employers and employees. They're in a relationship of interdependence, and what has happened over the last 50, 60 years is that the employees have become more vulnerable, have lost many of their securities of employment, have become, as we say now, ever more precarious. So what happens when they become precarious, many of them are actually excluded. They no longer have access to the labor market. They no longer have access to jobs. They no longer have access in many parts of the world to land. And it is this process of exclusion, of marginalization, that is slightly different, because the excluded, in a sense, are superfluous. They are the waste. Nobody is dependent upon them. Employers are actually dependent upon workers, but nobody's dependent upon the excluded. They are more likely to be a desperate group of people.
So then we have exclusion on the one hand and what you would call unequal inclusion on the other.
Right.
And to flesh out both categories, in a paper that you wrote, you point to two kind of pronouncements on inequality. And let's start with Pope Francis. What position, what stance has he taken on the issue of economic inequality?
Well, I think, what I refer to in that address was an apostolic exhortation. I think it was his first in 2013. And he came out with quite a remarkable statement about the character of modern capitalism, talking about processes of systematic exclusion, talking about the dangers of believing economists who talk about trickle down, the priority given in this world to profit, the ways in which we worship money. These were extraordinary statements to be coming from a pope. Of course, this was a very special pope. He's the first pope from the Global South, first of all, obviously from Argentina, and very influenced by some of the theological movements, liberation theology in the 1970s.
You were saying he focused more on exclusion than on other forms of inequality?
Yes, and that was actually, if you sort of diagnose what he was saying, he tended to talk much more about the excluded rather than the included. Since he is, I think, very much a representative of the Global South, exclusion actually is a more paramount problem than unequal inclusion. In fact, the excluded would love to be included, albeit unequally included. Because, today to have a job, to be employed as a wage laborer, is actually becoming increasingly a privilege. Increasing percentage of the population globally is actually excluded and don't have access to even the basic income that comes from employment. So I think that for that reason, he emphasized the excluded, what another very famous social theorist and political activist from Africa referred to as the wretched of the earth. That's Frantz Fanon. And he was writing already in the 1960s, he wrote that book in 1962, The Wretched of the Earth, which became a Bible of anti-colonial movements. But he too is referring to the excluded. He was referring particularly to the dispossessed peasantry in Africa, particularly, but other parts of the world also.
And if the excluded want to be included, and yet the included, many of the included, the workers, are exploited, what does it mean to you, or what does it say to you, that what they want, what they desire, is not such a good deal?
Well, that's the irony of the situation, that there's one thing worse than being exploited, that's not being exploited. Yeah, see, the situation for most people in the world is a pretty bleak one. There are relatively few people who can secure an independent existence. And so, employment today is becoming a more and more privileged position. And therefore, actually, the employed, though in the past they may have engaged in all sorts of social movements, struggles for the betterment of conditions, tend now to be more conservative for fear of losing their employment, their jobs. And we see that, of course, in the countries of the North and of the South. There's a militancy of the labor movement, with very crucial exceptions in this country, has fallen. Strikes are very few and far between these days. And that's a sign of the dependence of employees on their jobs and the fear that they may lose their jobs.
And then there's the French economist Thomas Piketty, who made a big splash internationally with his book Capital in the 21st Century. It was published in English in 2014. Over what span of time does Piketty look at income and wealth inequality?
Well, that is indeed one of his strengths. Economists don't usually look at inequality, but he is unusual in that regard, and unusual in the data he collected that goes back into the 19th century. And takes us all the way to the present and looks at different countries and comes to the conclusion that we are actually returning to the inequalities of the end of the 19th century, that there was a blip in the 20th century between, shall we say, 1935, 1940, and 1970, when inequality diminished. But whereas we tend to believe that that is the norm and that this rising inequality of the last 50 years is perhaps exceptional, he turned this on its head and basically said that that moment of sort of class compromise between workers and capitalists, between labor and business, that class compromise in which the working class advanced its positions, often with the help of trade unions, that those moments, those 30, 40, 50 years, actually were very exceptional, and that we are now returning to the vast inequalities of the end of the 19th century. This is, again, a very bleak prognosis, and he doesn't see any reversal, and ends the book sort of hoping that somehow new taxation structures will actually lead to some sort of diminution of inequality.
So taxing the rich is his proposed solution to inequality?
That's his proposed solution.
How does he explain the growth of inequality or the resumption of the growth of inequality in the 20th century since the 1970s?
Essentially, he's talking about the ways in which, and he puts it in economic language, but essentially he's saying that the wealthy have managed to sustain a systematic accumulation of wealth, and forces appropriating, taxing, redistributing that wealth have become weaker and weaker.
So you were telling me that the Pope Francis, he focused on the excluded. Is Piketty, is that his focus as well?
No, I think he's focusing on the more on the included. Most of his countries are in advanced capitalist, are from the sort of the global north. And yeah, his figures are really basically about the sort of the employed labor, not the excluded. So that's why there's an interesting sort of difference between the two, the one talking about the excluded and the other really talking about the included.
Michael Bourivoy joins us. He is professor of sociology at UC Berkeley. He was president of the International Sociological Association from 2010 to 2014, and he's written a lot of books, including Manufacturing Consent, Changes in the Labor Process Under Monopoly Capitalism, and Conversations with Bourdieu, the Johannesburg Moment, which he co-authored. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And you wrote, or you said in this address to the ISA, that both the Pope and Piketty were inspired, or at least influenced, by social movements. And I want to talk about that, but at first I want to get into this issue of kind of a neoliberal regime or marketization. And you actually don't particularly like the term neoliberalism. Why is that?
Well, I think that neoliberalism has a connotation that there is something new and different about the present period. And what I have argued, and I think this is consonant now with what Piketty writes, is that what we are experiencing now is a wave of marketization, the spread of markets and the way that different entities are becoming subject to market exchange, that this spread and expansion of the market is one of a series of expansions. We've had them before. We had them in the 19th century. We had them in the early 20th century. And now we have another one. I think they are different, but at least we should recognize that these waves of marketization are there to be explained, and we must understand them historically.
And when you say spread and expansion of markets, do you mean that markets are being established in certain areas that they were not before, such that things, more things, are being brought into kind of a buy, to be bought or to be sold regimen?
Right. They've spread geographically. One of the interesting consequences of the fall of the Soviet Union and its satellites in Eastern Europe is the spread of a market economy into those countries. Those countries were largely organized around an administered economy, a planned economy, and what determined what people produced and how they produced it was sort of in a principle centrally directed. Whereas now they are subject to market forces. The same thing one might say in China, that has undergone rapid marketization, so that labor, for example, is itself subject to market forces. Labor sells itself in a marketplace. There is competition for jobs in the way that there wasn't before. Entrepreneurs emerge that are independent, that sort of buy and sell things, that organize production independently, rather than it being state-controlled. So markets have spread geographically, but markets have also entered into new arenas. You know, we even talk now about parts of the human body that have become commodities that are bought and sold. Religion, I was walking through Sproul Plaza the other day and people were trying to sort of attract people's attention. These were some religious groups saying, you know, if you come and talk to us about God, then we will give you a cookie. There's a sort of exchange relationship going on here. So ever more entities in society are subject to processes of exchange, processes in which buyers and sellers enter into a relationship with one another and bargain over prices. This is the, so marketization spreads geographically, it spreads to different entities, and it also deepens. So if we go back again to the question of labor, labor in the United States, and similarly in other countries, but let's stick with the United States. Labor in the United States after the New Deal, was managed to actually develop sort of defenses through trade unions, through collective bargaining, through grievance machinery, through minimum wage laws, through unemployment compensation. These were sort of ways in which labor was actually defended. And the sale of labor or labor power or was regulated. But what happens after the 1970s was that many of these regulations that defended labor, including, in fact, the trade unions themselves and the ideas of collective bargaining, were turned against labor. They either disappeared or they were turned against labor. And so labor became an unregulated commodity subject to the pressures of the marketplace, which, of course, was to the advantage of capital, but nevertheless to the disadvantage, or at least the short-term interests of capital, and to the disadvantage of workers. So we see that markets expand geographically. They expand to different commodities, entities, and they also have been deepened. Marketization has deepened and turned what were defensive organizations, turned them against, either destroyed them or turned them against the very entities they were defending.
In addition to labor, what other major categories of things would you say have been commodified?
We're in the business of commodifying nature one way or another. I think that's one of the most pressing challenges of today, of course, is climate change. And so how are we handling climate change? Well, basically, we're turning nature into a market. We are actually beginning to charge capitalists for pollution. So capitalists can now pay to pollute the atmosphere. And indeed, they do pay to pollute the atmosphere. The idea is that this will restrict their pollution, but there is no evidence that that is happening, that this marketization of one of our economic relationship to nature, there's no evidence that that is actually reducing climate change. And so, again, that's a case of marketization designed to offset global warming, but actually not being effective in so doing.
And you're talking about the carbon trading,
right?
Those markets, uh-huh.
Right.
So there is labor, there is land or nature.
Right. And then, of course, there is money. Money itself has become a commodity. And, of course, that is manifests itself in finance capital. That is making money from money. And these are all, the latter two are sort of global in character. So finance capital moves around the world very rapidly, investing here, investing there, speculating here and speculating there, speculating in some currencies, not in others, and creating economic crises. And is left to its own devices. There is very little control over the movement of finance capital. So that's the third commodity that is being commodified, that is money.
And then there is a fourth commodity. And, you know, you use in your writings the term fictitious commodity, which actually suggests that something is not, in fact, a commodity when it's called a commodity. But maybe you could define fictitious commodity and also point to the fourth category of thing that is being commodified.
Okay. Now, I should refer to a great sociologist, economist by the name of Karl Polanyi at this point, because I'm borrowing many of his ideas, trying to revise them. Karl Polanyi was originally Hungarian. He was a intellectual who was part of a populist movement before World War I. And he was born in Hungary and grew up in Hungary and then left Hungary after World War I for Austria. He essentially was a intellectual who saw the market as a problematic entity if it was not kept in check. And so many of my ideas are influenced by his theories. And what he argued is that if you push marketization too far, you're going to get a reaction. Now, we'll come to the reaction in a minute. But let me just say that by marketization, he meant, in particular, the commodification of, as I've been talking about, labor, land, and money. And he says that basically these three entities, which are crucial to our survival on this planet, if they are subject to commodification, to the forces of the market, to the uncontrolled processes of exchange between buyers and sellers, if the market is actually becomes the regulator of these entities, then that will endanger society. So he called these entities, these particular commodities, fictitious commodities. And by that he meant they are commodities that should not be commodified, or at least not commodified in an unregulated fashion. So he was very much concerned about what is the destiny of particularly labor, nature, and money. Well, what he didn't consider was this fourth commodity, which is the one that I'm quite interested in, and that is knowledge. And I think the commodification of knowledge, the buying and selling of knowledge in the marketplace, is also endangering society. Because who can buy knowledge? They're usually the rich and the wealthy, and they buy it to advance their profits. Whereas knowledge in the past has been something we collectively own. And today it is controlled by those with money and power. And so the very knowledge that we so desperately need to actually reorchestrate the global economy is being appropriated by those who are actually perpetuating the expansion of markets and their disastrous consequences. So, and of course, this process of commodification of knowledge is taking place in universities. Universities increasingly have become almost profit centers. As the public university has lost its funding, so the universities had to seek money elsewhere. And where does it seek it? It seeks it from donors, from alumni, but also from corporations. And so the very source of what had been collectively owned, collectively produced knowledge is becoming increasingly controlled by, directed by large enterprises with interests other than the collective good.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Michael Borovoy joins me in studio. He is a sociologist based at UC Berkeley, and he's written a lot of books, including The Politics of Production, Factory Regimes Under Capitalism and Socialism, The Color of Class on the Copper Mines, and Manufacturing Consent, Changes in the Labor Process Under Monopoly Capitalism. We have a link to his faculty page at UC Berkeley on our website, againstthegrain.org. So what have been the consequences of this privatization of knowledge for university faculty, for students, for the whole educational process?
Yes, well, I think insofar as the university has to become a money-making enterprise, it has devoted a lot of attention to seeking out different sources of revenue. And interestingly, it has created a whole new administrative structure of highly paid executives whose business is to seek money, to persuade others to give universities money, particularly public universities. And it has done all sorts of strange things in order to get that money. For example, athletics becomes a very important part of the university because successful athletics apparently brings in donors, and donors, of course, are crucial when you are seeking revenue. So universities will devote a lot of money to athletics, and it turns out that athletics loses a huge amount of money as a result, in the hope that it will recoup those losses from the donors. But anyway, the point is that university seeks money in ways that detract from the actual educational project of research and teaching. And so it distorts the very goal, the very purpose, the very functioning of the university. And this is, of course, a tendency that is we can see across the country. And, of course, it's happening in other countries, too.
The commodification of knowledge, I'm wondering what relationship you see that having with the commodification of those other three factors, land, labor, and money. Are they all separate and distinct spheres and processes of commodification, or are they related in some way?
No, I think you're absolutely right. That's a very important point, that actually the commodification of knowledge facilitates the commodification of labor by producing and designing new ways of exploiting labor, and new ways of organizing finance, and actually becomes the ways in which this carbon trading, the market has been created in carbon trading, has been constituted. So there's an example. Knowledge actually has implications for the other three fictitious commodities.
Now, you were saying earlier that Polanyi was interested in and concerned by over-marketization, but he also had this idea of a counter-movement, which I assume means a movement in resistance to marketization and commodification. What kinds of counter movements did he see arising in relation to the commodification of the three factors he identified, which were, again, labor, land, and money?
Well, he didn't, when it came to studying so-called counter movement, he didn't necessarily distinguish between these fictitious commodities. He's writing in 1944 a book called The Great Transformation. And what he sees is that there is this uneven but nevertheless continuous expansion of the market beginning at the end of the 19th century and that continues into the 20th century. And he sees social movements responding to this marketization. Now, it is true that when he talks about social movements in the 19th century, he's actually talking about the labor movement, and he's talking about the development of trade unions, political parties, labor parties. He's mainly talking about Europe. He's talking about the development of cooperatives in which workers get together to insulate themselves, in a sense, from the market. So that's the 19th century. And then comes the 20th century. And now it is not the sort of spontaneous labor movement that is responding to marketization. Now it is states that are responding to marketization. And what he sees in the 1930s is the problematic reaction to the market. He's coming from Hungary and Austria, in fact, fleeing Austria in 1933, he's very conscious, uppermost in his mind, is where indeed did fascism come from. And his argument is it really was a response to the expansion of the market, whether in the form of Italian fascism or German Nazism. He saw these as responses to the overextension of the market. Indeed, he even saw changes in the Soviet Union, as it was then, in the 1920s, was a response to marketization. That the planning and collectivization in the Soviet Union was a response, a reaction to marketization. But all these responses, and there were others, the New Deal as being another one, all these responses were state-centric. They basically were states' attempt to regulate the market. And that regulation can take, you know, a social democratic form, as it did with the New Deal, as it did in the Scandinavian countries. But what concerned him most was the fascist response. And so he saw that the overextension of markets led to rather problematic consequences when it comes to or can lead to problematic consequences for freedom. So he was very, very committed to trying to sort of ensure that we never again would enter into sort of a utopian project of unleashing markets.
And did he not believe that, based on prior experience, humanity would decide not to make the mistake of overexpanding markets?
Yeah, he thought that having written this book and having studied this matter, he decided in 1944, that humanity, indeed, as you said, would never again make the mistake of unleashing markets, given the consequences it had revolving around World War II. But he had this great belief in the importance of beliefs, in the importance of moral commitments, and in the rationality of the human race. And as we know, there has been, another round of marketization that begins, you know, in the Thatcher-Reagan era of the 1970s. This he did not anticipate, I think, because he believed too strongly in the importance of ideas, that they can actually sort of make history. So we need to actually rethink Polanyi. We have to recognize there was not just one long wave of marketization leading to the 1930s and then this reaction, but there were at least two waves, one in the 19th and another in the 20th. And then we have to recognize that there is a third wave of marketization that begins in the 1970s. And we have to really think very hard about why capitalism generates these waves of marketization if we are actually begin to have a chance to regulate and control them.
His name is Michael Borivoy. He's a sociologist at UC Berkeley. We are discussing a lot of things, including an address he gave to the International Sociological Association, which became an article, an essay in Current Sociology. But he's been developing these ideas over a period of time. Delighted to have him join us in studio. We'll take a short break and speak more with Michael Borivoy. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Michael Borivoy joins me, B-U-R-A-W-O-Y. He is a professor of sociology at UC Berkeley, and he was president of the International Sociological Association from 2010 to 2014. So if Karl Polanyi did not anticipate this, what you call third wave of marketization, if he saw the response to the marketization that happened in the 19th century as kind of labor-based, so really more of an individual, right, these workers coming together and collectively acting together to effect change. And then in response to what happened in the early 20th century, you were saying that Polanyi saw it as more of a state-centered response, whether in the form of the New Deal or in the form of fascism and Stalinism. Then the question becomes, well, in this era of the third wave of marketization, which some people would call neoliberalism, and you've already explained why you're not comfortable with that term, the question becomes, what counter movement, what social movement or network of movements can arise that can resist and effectively challenge this current method and wave of marketization? Do you see labor on kind of a local level or state responses, responses on the national level, as being sufficient to act against the current wave of marketization before it's too late?
Well, they may be necessary, but something else is even more necessary. That is a global reaction to marketization. You see, the finance capital, the challenge of regulating nature, and specifically climate change, and also the characteristics of labor today, that these commodifications, these marketizations are operating at a global level. And the only way to tackle them, to contain them, is also at a global level. So Polanyi had, in the 19th century, sort of local resistance of labor. And it tended to be indeed a quite effective counter-movement that regulated the commodification of labor. Then we have state-centric responses, but now we need global responses. And the question is, how does one even think about global responses? If we look at the social movements of today, well, when I was giving my address in 2014, I was thinking a lot about the movements of the 2011, 2012, 2013, which were movements like the Occupy movement, movements like the Indignados in Spain, movements like the Arab Spring. These can all, and similar movements in Latin America, one can see all these movements as an indeed a response to the expansion of marketization. But they all had a national character. And when we think, already in 2014, I had premonitions of a, not these more left-wing, but also emerging right-wing movements. We already saw them then. I mean, the Arab Spring had been dissolved, and in its place, there were a very different type of nationalist movements had emerged. We saw nationalist movements emerging in India. We saw them emerging actually in Europe of a right-wing character, 2014, 2015, until today. Of course, we have just recently had quite a nice efflorescence of nationalism in this country too. So what we see is there's a movement from left-wing to more nationalist right-wing movements, fine, but they are all national movements still. They are not global movements. And so that's the paradox, I think, is that there are movements, and one can see even in this resurgence of nationalism around the Trump phenomenon, the ways in which Trump wants to sort of what? He wants to sort of enclose the United States, and now talks about walls, talks about limiting free trade. This is similar to the reaction of countries in the 1930s, particularly sort of Nazi Germany, Austria, Italy, basically also trying to build national economies and sort of insulating them from the world economy. But today, I don't believe that such nationalism will be effective in regulating markets of a global character. So, yeah, we're in a real pickle. We are not really being able to think globally when we think of movements of resistance to expansion of marketization. So, yeah, so what the future has in store is really problematic. It's difficult for me to imagine at this point. So some people talk about labor being a potential, always had that potentiality of cross-national organization. But labor movements are A, on the defensive, and B, they're fighting sort of locally and nationally, not fighting globally. There are some alliances across national boundaries, but very few. Most of what's left of the labor movement tends to be organized at national level or local level.
What about climate change, efforts to address climate change? And that, you know, that seems to have a very distinctly global context. Do you see any potential there?
There are definitely social movements of a global character that are taking on climate change, are demanding much more significant regulation of the way that we organize our economy and produce global warming. But I think ultimately the saving of this planet will probably depend not so much on these social movements, strong though some of them are, most of them not effective in regulating capitalism. It'll depend upon capitalists themselves realizing that the future of capitalism itself is at stake. And it will require enlightened capitalists to begin to organize a much more severe regulation of the way that they plunder nature. Yeah, so it's as we all know, these are not very optimistic scenarios. And now we have a president who denies there is something called climate change and global warming, that doesn't augur well for the future. But at least climate change is clearly seen by all as something that is global. And so everybody recognizes that you have to tackle this globally. The Paris negotiations and agreement, I mean, they're unenforceable. They're not, so they are gestural. We have to be much more tough about the way we regulate capitalism than came out of the Paris talks.
We're speaking with Michael Borovoy on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He's a sociologist at UC Berkeley. So the Arab Spring, right? It emerged with great fervor, great energy, and then it was repressed in so many locations. Occupy Wall Street, it had its moment, and then it withered away in many ways. But people look at such efflorescences, if you will, and say, well, you know, there was a political consciousness that emerged, that a seed was planted in many people's minds that the status quo was not suitable, that the marketization, the commodification that was occurring in relation to labor or land or money or knowledge wasn't acceptable. And so we should be optimistic because this kind of political consciousness was cultivated and could be drawn upon again as part of a much larger movement, or maybe, you know, maybe a movement of the same size. What do you make of those arguments?
Well, I wish they were true. And possibly they are true. The legacy of those movements, in part, may well be the sense that history is not sort of given, and that the future is not given, and the present is sort of not just natural and inevitable. On the other hand, the consciousness may take on a more negative character. If one thinks, for example, you spoke of the Arab Spring, one thinks of what happened in Egypt. I mean, sort of totally unbelievable that Mubarak should be subject to this extraordinary outpouring of popular opposition. I mean, now still in front of my eyes, I see the crowds in Tahrir Square. And people remember these moments of exaltation and collective effervescence and hope for an alternative world. And then those hopes are dashed and comes Sisi, a new dictator, military dictator, in some ways even worse than Mubarak. And it is a sense in which people might conclude that, well, there was hope, but now there is no hope. That hope has been dashed, and that it shows that social movements can only bring problems. You can get a really pessimistic outlook on the future out of the ways in which the Arab Spring has dissolved. So it works both ways. I think on the one hand, one can draw the more hopeful interpretation is that, yes, we can see that there was a moment when we did fight and we were successful. And then for others, the very fact that it was so short-lived and with so relatively few sort of material consequences leads to even greater despondency.
And we can look at social movements, but a lot of people who are excluded and marginalized are not part of movements. So I guess that needs to be taken into account as well.
Yes, indeed. All right. So the processes of dispossession from access to labor or land, they do not necessarily form movements at all. Indeed, I began studying Karl Polanyi when I found myself in Russia in the 1990s. And what I saw there was the systematic attempt at destroying what was the Soviet state in the hope that this shock therapy would actually spontaneously generate markets. Well, markets came, but they came with a very destructive character and with very, very short time horizons. And they led to a fall and decline in the economy, in the Soviet, well, post-Soviet economy, the likes of which we had never, ever seen in the 20th century. And so what one saw is that the mass of the population became ever more reliant upon subsistence agriculture, on make work, on sort of collectives. And so they didn't form movements, they sort of were in retreat. And so there was no sort of counter movement to the rapid expansion of the market. And of course, there hasn't been since then either. So Polanyi was very optimistic. He thought that, you know, these counter movements had to happen, because if they didn't happen, society would be destroyed. But he didn't have a theory of why they necessarily had to happen. And he had observed historically that they did happen. But we can also see that they don't necessarily happen. And markets can actually sustain themselves without generating opposition. So that's, I think, a very important question. Under what circumstances do markets generate opposition? And what is the character of that opposition?
In what you are saying about marketization, are you saying that you are against markets per se?
It has to be asked. It has to be asked, yes. Well, first of all, yes. No, I'm not saying necessarily one has to be against markets. My first position would be that they have to be regulated. And my second response would be to say that, well, one of the reasons why I spent so many years in Hungary, socialist Hungary, and then in, well, what was post-Soviet Russia, was to see exactly how that form of socialism, which I call state socialism, how it actually functioned, supposedly without the market, through a planned economy. And what was so interesting, particularly about my experiences in Hungary, was that essentially Hungary was a very, in the 1970s and the 1980s, was a successful economy, more affluent in my view as a whole than it is today. But it was affluent because it had managed to actually combine state regulation with markets. You know, both state regulation and market economies have their problems. And what Hungary had managed to do was to actually see how that each could complement the other. So if, for example, in the issue of, I don't know, housing, you know, in principle, housing is state-built in a socialist country. It's state-built and state-planned, state-organized. And, well, it turns out that state housing often gets distributed to a sort of bureaucratic technical class. And the working class actually doesn't have access to much of the new housing. So the Hungarian government decided, well, what we're going to do is we're going to create a market in bricks, in glass, in wood, so that workers can actually buy the materials, form collectives, cooperatives, and build their own housing, which is precisely what they did. And this sort of, in a sense, reduced the inequality that was generated by a state-administered economy. Yes, I've been very impressed by the capacity for markets to actually supplement state regulation. And we see in social democratic countries, or even in this country, that actually markets need to be supplemented by state regulation. So they're two. What I'm saying is they're two have to really probably go together. Perhaps in my youth, I might think that a planned economy might function. But today, I think it cannot function without the support of markets, that they each require the other.
So you've written that it is important to challenge the supremacy of the market, that the movements that you hope will arise on a global level have to represent a fundamental challenge to marketization. Well, there are a lot of movements that are fairly strong and robust that don't seem to me to be anti-marketization or anti-commodification. Let's take some of the movements that focus on race or gender. So there it seems to be more about countering discrimination or discriminatory brutality. It's a plea for a demand for equality rather than, to me, it seems, an opposition to a stance against marketization. Although, of course, if you take what's going on in around the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, there are issues around profit and around land and dispossession. But what would you say about some of these movements that seem to draw a lot of attention and a lot of people, and yet maybe don't have that focus on marketization that you might think incredibly important to the current moment, the current wave of marketization?
Right. No, that's very important. But if you take Black Lives Matter, a movement like that, which is obviously concerned with the discriminatory character of the repressive apparatuses of this country, those repressive apparatuses are operating in ghettos, in areas that are almost wastelands when it comes to institutions, labor markets. And so I think one has to see the state to which Black Lives Matter is very hostile. One has to see the state itself as regulating processes of impoverishment that are themselves the result of marketization. There's a book that's just been written by a sociologist, Matthew Desmond, called Evicted, which is about the housing insecurity in Milwaukee and the extraordinary, appalling conditions under which the population in the inner city has to live, but particularly with reference to housing insecurity and the ever-present threat of eviction or dispossession. And this processes of dispossession and eviction and landlords charging exorbitant rents, these processes are themselves the product of markets. And it is in that context that we have a sort of a repressive state needed to regulate what are now the excluded. And in a sense, so even a movement like Black Lives Matter gets entangled in the consequences of marketization. But of course, the movement itself is not focused per se on marketization, but it is operating in a context that is created by marketization.
Michael Burovoy, Burovoy, professor of sociology at UC Berkeley. We have a link to his faculty page at Berkeley on our website, againstthegrain.org. You can find and learn about all of the books and articles and other projects that Michael has been involved in and engaged in over many years. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, CS. That was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
And I first met, you might say cornered, Michael at the American Sociological Association annual meeting in Seattle in August. We've put a link to the ASA on our website, againstthegrain.org. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.